And that was Bob Dylan with, what was the title? Sorry, I can't remember.
Lily, Rosemary, and the Jack of Hearts.
Lily, Rosemary, and the Jack of Hearts from a brilliant album, Blood on the Tracks. Probably the best, well, for me, best Dylan album. Hey, how do I get back onto where I need to be now? Sorry, technical difficulties here with the computer. All right, so no, I want to get out of that. So I just click out, right? Boom. Boom. But how do I get back to...
Log in.
Yeah, where I was. I already logged in, though. Is there a way to get where I was? Resume. Thank you. Sorry about that. All right, well, that was my problem. Good thing there's a software engineer in the building. That was my... little technical glitch. Sorry you had to hear that. And you are listening to WMFO 91.5 FM, Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio, and we're a little slice of that community-based socialist alternative radio, talk and music from a working-class democratic socialist perspective. By the way, if you want professional radio, you got to get paid. So I don't get paid for this, which is fine. But, you know, that's so... No complaints. If I have a computer glitch and have to get it worked out. So, again, welcome to today's show, and we're going to be focusing on, if you're a new listener to this show, Socialist Alternative Radio, we are not really about just what you might think, like alternative information for you. Oh, we do some of that. We want you to have, if you're a progressive, if you're a socialist, if you want to be a socialist, we want to give you information you can use to make the case with people, you know, in a class, at your workplace, in your family. You know, how many people are into that? I fell into it at a young age, arguing with family members. Now, when I first was doing it, it was from a, you know, kind of more of a conservative perspective when I was a kid, you know, sort of mimicking what I was hearing around me and seeing around me, and but still having certain angles on things that maybe didn't fit with what everyone else was saying, and I would get in arguments, you know, and I want to know my stuff, you know, and so yeah, there's some of that going on here. We're trying to know our stuff, right? We're trying to have our facts straight, tell the truth, you know, get into an argument and plant a seed. You're not going to convince most people you talk to, by the way. If you're thinking of becoming an activist or an organizer, you know, I've done a lot of union organizing, a lot of organizing for socialism. When you're involved in that, don't expect to, you know, have someone say, yes, I agree 100% after you've convinced me from my position that was pretty not, didn't make much sense, really. you know, sorry, I got distracted there. You have to realize that a lot of times when you're talking to someone, you're just planting a seed for the future. If you're telling the truth, the general... Or, I mean, no one has a crystal ball. No one can predict the future. But if you're telling the truth about a general situation and the general situation pans out you know, it can be in a general way. Sorry to keep using the word general. But, in a way that, hey, wait a minute. Yeah, things aren't working right. Things are unfair. This wasn't good what they did to this person, et cetera. I mean, I'll give you a very stark example. When I was a kid, still mimicking a lot of conservative ideas from, you know, my working class conservative area I grew up in, working class conservative family, you know there are plenty of progressive working class areas, but this was not one of those. And a friend of mine at school mainly we talked about science fiction novels and sports, and he was like all about we talked about Star Trek and stuff, you know, and all of a sudden this is in the mid-70s, early to mid-70s when I was a kid, and all of a sudden you know, you can't avoid talking politics. Sometimes there's times in society where you can't avoid talking politics. You know, not that I wanted to avoid it. I never had a problem talking politics. But, you know, most people or a lot of people are taught it's bad to do that. You know, don't you know, care that much, really, is what people are taught here. You know, in the U.S., only care about yourself, you know. Go on to any Facebook debate and you'll get that real quick. But, digression, full excuse for this digression, but someone on Facebook posted that Amtrak has now created a situation where you can only get in the dining car if you have a higher paying ticket. So if you're just in coach or whatever they call it, they don't let you in the dining car anymore. And this used to be for people that, you know, in the past when railroad, when war people rode railroads and, you know, coming back to a certain extent, people are, you know, in heavily traveled areas and so on, like the Northeast Corridor, this would actually be a thing. You know, you're looking forward to, if there's a dining car, maybe eating something or going cross country on a long trip or something. Actually, I'm not sure the Northeast Corridor has dining cars anymore, but unfortunately. So Amtrak decides to make a greater hierarchy than the hierarchy that you have with the ticket, different ticket prices to begin with. And they basically, they basically did this thing, and it went on a Facebook, because I'm on all these railroads. I'm not like a railroad geek. Nothing's wrong with that, but I like railroads, you know. But I'm not like, I'm not making the models in my basement. I wish I was, you know, but I'm not. First thing I read is someone writes in and said, I bring my own food on the train. Oh my God. And I just wrote back, missing the point completely. You know, I mean, does it kill you to have a little empathy? Does it destroy your worldview if you realize that people have different situations, you know, that, you know, they, you don't have to just give us your personal survival story, which, by the way, always has holes in it and always falls apart at a certain point. When I was union organizing, and I still, you know, do a sort of union organizing in the sense of talking to union workers that are in struggle and so on, and give advice to union workers that I know. And then I'm in my own union doing union organizing of a sort activity at a lower scale than I used to. But anyway, you know, you find out, you know, someone says something like, I do this and this works, I get ahead, why don't you do this? And then you find out what they're suggesting just doesn't work or just falls apart at a certain point, you know? I mean, the obvious example is somebody that works really, really hard for the company, real company man or woman, you know? And then all of a sudden, boom, they get laid off. Or they get demoted or something. They thought that their hard work would pay off. And, you know, no. I mean, I've seen people leave. I've worked in a place long enough. I work at Harvard University, which is a crappy, crappy employer and just a greedy, greedy place to work, contrary to what you may have heard. A greedy, greedy, greedy institution that has more money than anything, and they still are always trying to rip people off, always trying to hurt people with their policies that they consider necessary for some reason. Yes, we need to, you know, get workers that we don't pay enough to pay more for health care. We need to limit raises. God forbid that you, or not give them at all. You know, we need to lay you off if you start to get old and start getting a higher salary, you know, that kind of thing. Typical, they run this nonprofit like a bloodthirsty Fortune 500 corporation. Oh, but wait a minute. It turns out they have a lot of Fortune 500 and other investments, you know. But, you know, it's, I've seen people leave in this workplace that have put in many, many years. And the minute they're gone, they put someone else in, or they don't fill their position to make the people that are left behind work more, which is happening to me and other people that are in my area of work, literally area, I mean, and type of work, I guess you could say as well. You know, understaffing is all the rage where I work. And people I see, they really identify with the job, you know, and this includes higher up people. But the minute they leave, they're forgotten. They are forgotten. They bring somebody else in, or they just don't fill the position, and the machine churns on. The corporate machine churns on without you. Nobody in corporate landia is immune, indispensable. You're just a machine, and you're just a part of the machine. You're just a little cog in the machine, as they used to say, and you're not going to, they're not going to be any different. So if you're going to defend that system, if you're going to put your heart and soul into that, one day the lecturing you give somebody else about how to get along is going to fall apart. It's going to be a lie. It's going to be a lie. I mean, I remember, and I'll give you another anecdote. I remember in college sitting at a table all excited as a freshman in college, and it was the first parent weekend. My parents lived too far away to attend, and they probably couldn't get the time off from work anyway. So I'm looking at these. So who ends up going, of course, is the, you know, richer kids' parents. And this one guy was like lecturing an entire table of business wannabe students, I guess. I went to two different schools. I transferred in to a different school after 2 years. But I went to a school called St. Bonaventure University for 2 years. Hated it right from the get-go. Couldn't extricate myself. Couldn't get out of it right away because of various reasons. I managed to get out after 2 years and go to a bigger school, better school, for my tastes anyway. And so this guy's lecturing his son and a bunch of other people that, you know, the way to go is Kodak in Rochester. I think it was Kodak, one of those big, you know, old photography giants, you know, making film and stuff. I think it was Kodak. You get a job in Kodak in Rochester, you're set for life. I've been there 20 years and it's beautiful, blah, blah, blah. You know, within about 5 years, that place started to go downhill quick and it disappeared even quicker. So, you know, no. If you listen to people about stability under capitalism or future under capitalism, you're listening to the wrong people. You know, they either don't understand the problems with the environment, the climate change stuff, or they don't understand the stuff about what a corporation is. Corporations are about making money. You know, they ask Henry Ford, you know, they ask capitalists. You get this quote from a lot of different capitalists, not just Henry Ford, but the most famous is Henry Ford, who said that the fascist creepo Henry Ford, by the way. If anyone teaches you in school, they teach people like Henry Ford. They teach people like him that they say they're heroes in our school system here in the United States. And by the way, we have international listeners, so I'm grounding this in the United States. So they teach that Henry Ford is here. Henry Ford was a fascist. He was scum. He exploited labor. He polluted nature. He ruined lives, you know, and he didn't do a lick of work. It was the workers that he exploited that created the Model T, Ford, and all that other stuff and got it and actually made it, you know. But anyway, Ford was like, I'm in the business of making money, not in the business of making cars. They all say that if they're honest, he wasn't honest in most ways, but I think that was an honest quote. The capitalists are in the business of making money, not making X, not doing blank, you know, and that's, you got to be aware of that. If you're not, you're in for a big, not just a emotional, intellectual letdown and betrayal, but your survival could be at stake. Do you think people that are homeless thought they were going to be homeless? Do you think you're immune from that? Do you think you'll never be homeless? You think people that get into debt over medical debt in this country or in all sorts of other debt that end up losing their homes. Maybe they're not homeless, but maybe they're couch surfing. Maybe they're, forced to live in a dangerous neighborhood in a little apartment after they owned a place in the burbs or something. And, not that that's nirvana or something, but that's, you know, that's something, having a home or the bank having it and you pretending to have it, which is my case and many other people's. You know, if you think that you're immune from that kind of crisis under capitalism, especially now with a boom, people tend to forget, you know, people can get jobs, wages. I mean, I think everyone agrees, even the corporate media, that wages are low and flat. Federal minimum wage, $7.25 an hour, nothing. That you can't even go even close to living on that anywhere in the country. But still, the pressure's not on us again yet. A lot of us remember 2007, 2008, 2009, of course, but still, you know, there's a new generation comes up and, oh, yeah, I can get a job. I can get two jobs. Oh, the gig economy, blah, 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 blah. Now, a lot of people see through it, but some don't. And they start to raise families and they, you know, tell other people this is the way to go. This is the way to live. This is brilliant. And no, it's not. It's not. It's a crisis-driven, a crisis-worn economic system, capitalism. It's going to come. It's going to bite you in the butt sooner or later. And not just you as an individual, but your family and everyone you love and care about. And it's going to be hell at a certain point. But if you skate through, if you're one of the rich people that skate through without getting hit or not understanding how your life is twisted by capitalism, even if you're rich, you're not going to come to that conclusion. Or you're going to say there's no alternative or whatever. There's alternatives. There's many alternatives and that are based in human solidarity, that are based in empathy, that are based in figuring out who really creates the wealth and who should really control the wealth. And that's really the essence of socialism. And then deciding how to use it. And that's the essence of democracy, which we don't have. We don't have. All the real important democratic decisions are happening in a very undemocratic way in big corporate boardrooms. They're not happening out in the streets. They're not happening in the neighborhoods. They're not happening even the government. The government is very, very powerful in the United States, but it's controlled by big business, obviously, by the big corporations, and they wall off certain decisions and say, no, that's the decision of big business. We can't touch that. They're even to the point now where they don't even consider taxing big business most of the time. They can't, you know, crawling back from a time when they were more afraid of the working class in this country, they being the government, the ruling class, and the corporate ruling class that runs the government or is part of it. Let me go back to that anecdote you thought. I forgot about that if you were listening earlier about how people change their minds. Again, Social Alternative Radio, this show is not about, we don't expect you to walk away from your radio if you're a liberal or a conservative that hasn't thought about how the system itself, how capitalism is wrong and needs to be fundamentally changed. If you haven't really given that serious thought and maybe you don't want to, we don't expect you to walk away from one show thinking, you know, as, oh, hey, I'm a socialist, I'm going to go start reading Marx and others and figure this stuff out, or go to a meeting and work with others to figure stuff out. You don't have to become an intellectual or anything to be a socialist. Reading does help. Reading helps with everything. But so what happens is that oftentimes when you're organizing, whether it's for socialism, for a union, for a lot of different things, for, you know, get someone in your neighborhood to help out with a petition or something that you really want in the neighborhood or something, it's a process. And maybe that sounds like common sense, but you'd be surprised. People expect the force of argument, their moral persuasion will carry the day. And no, it's a process. People oftentimes respond on a personal level. They don't understand politics at all. I mean, nobody understands it fully, but no, they don't understand it at all. And they're just always reacting on a personal level. So if they trust you, they may probably go along with what you have to say. But you shouldn't rely on that. You should give people the arguments and the methods and the knowledge to pursue their own line of thinking, and they come to hopefully the same conclusion, given that the conditions are what you describe or close to what you describe, and so on. So I find when people agree right away, I'll still kind of start making the arguments. They'll be like, yeah, I know. And I'll be like, okay, but just, you know, bam, 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 here's some facts. Maybe you can use them with the next person. And then I don't have to be the only one going around getting this petition or whatever. So, but a lot of times it's, yeah, they don't know you that well. They don't, so therefore they don't trust you. They are new to any kind of criticism or argument of things that they held dear, that they have been brainwashed about by the system. Or they are, you know, just of a different mindset. They have looked into things and they discovered something, you know, that seems to fit their worldview. And that's their set of ideas and facts and so on. So they're ideologically hostile, you know. So how do you make inroads with any of those types of people? Is that usually it's a process that you, maybe if you're lucky, especially with that last category, you plant a seed, you know, with someone that's ideologically just opposed and you know, actively pursuing a foreign ideology. I'll say foreign in the general sense of foreign to the working class. So that's a bad word to use, foreign, but let's say an ideology that harms working people and harms them, actually, but they embrace it anyway. Like, and you'll say people that voted for Trump, and I'll agree, people that vote for Trump, yeah, but also people that vote for the Democrats. It's the same two corporate parties that aren't the same, but they're very similar when it comes to certain things like defending capitalism, defending imperialism, and so on. So when you do things that aren't in your own interest, people say, why do people do that? Well, again, it's, they don't see an alternative. They're not meant to see an alternative. Years of conditioning, years of brainwashing, et cetera. But it's not insurmountable, because at the end of the day, people's experience is going to teach them more than a lot of other things. And it's not enough just experiencing something, but it's experiencing something and then running into somebody or running into an organization or hopefully in the future an actual political party in this country that is not bought and paid for by the big corporations. And then people will consider alternatives. Now, you know, that doesn't mean it's the end of the story. In Europe, people have had, in other places of the world, people have had socialist, you know, alternatives, no pun intended, in mass political parties that claimed they were for socialist revolution and they were going to change things fundamentally. And they had moments, they had time, they had time frames, they had windows of opportunity where it looked like that was happening, and they gained major reforms and started to change things and got more and more support and so on. But then there's these crucial moments where they're sort of put up or shut up moments, and they happen in like Venezuela recently with the Chavez regime, before he died. And there's many, many, many examples historically, and very few of them so far, although capitalism is a very new system historically, very few of them have resulted in social revolutions, in socialist revolutions. And they and if they don't get that far, or the organizations are too timid to even try, then and they're basically they're falling back into supporting capitalism in one way or another, and the people see that and they say that's not really an alternative. Then they look around and say, well, so why should I bother? Why don't I just go with something that pushes my buttons in some other way? Or why don't I go with something I know is not going to really change things, but it's sort of lesser evilism, you know, that kind of thing. And then the situation, then the problems get worse. The problems that capitalism creates and spreads every day, in terms of inequality and instability, and on a world scale, we're not experiencing it right now directly. Although it depends where you are. It depends if you're a U.S. Soldier in Afghanistan or something. We're in war. Constant wars under capitalism is what I'm getting at. And I'm just sort of thinking in the United States, most people are unaware or don't feel the fact that there are wars happening on a constant basis under capitalism. And there are wars even that this country is involved in or set up the situations for in a big way, and still not much feeling about that, not much hearing about that. But anyway, back to that anecdote I keep putting off, but it's a good one. It's a good one. I like it. It was something I learned in through my own experience. Going back to I think I was in ninth grade or something, in this mid-70s, and, when Watergate started to break, 73, 74, I think. And this friend of mine who, we had never really talked politics before, all of a sudden he goes, in passing, because you couldn't avoid the headlines at that time, you couldn't avoid the politics. Which is a good thing, actually. And he was like, Nixon's a crook. I'm like, what do you mean Nixon's a crook? And I was really actually taken aback, because seriously, in my neighborhood, in my working class conservative world, in my neighborhood and my way to school and all that, everyone I knew actually did either was completely apolitical, or they were actually supportive of Nixon when he ran against Humphrey. And what was it, 68? They were patriotic. They were, a lot of people were in the war that I knew, my brother, including one of my brothers. And it just didn't occur, to question at that level that the president was an authority figure. They still try to inculcate that authority. The corporate media, you see it with Trump, Mr. President, the president. Well, he's the president, that kind of thing. They're going after him, I mean, we're in an interesting time where the ruling class, the capitalist class, is really split. I mean, I don't mean 50-50 necessarily. I just mean that there's a wing of it that really wants to go after Trump and is using the corporate media to a certain extent to do that. And there's another wing that is fine with Trump, making big profits. Hey, everything's cool. They're not worried about the possible damage to this authority that they want to keep in the office of the presidency. And so, there's differences of opinion. And when it gets to this kind of more outright fighting, more obvious fighting that's happening in Congress now, as a socialist, it's like, hey, this is beautiful. Let's let the ruling class destroy itself, which is not really that serious yet. But that's really, it reflects tensions within the capitalist system as a whole. There's always competition between corporations. There's always different ideas from the big bosses, the big corporate CEOs, about where they should go, where the country should be going. Some of them want to bomb Iran, and others want to, keep stability so they can have a future view of where their investments are going and so on. And so basically it's like a lot of disagreement right now. And that can be a very good thing if there's an alternative to take advantage of that, And right now we don't have that. But, people are, I think, waking up, talking more about politics, so that's a good thing. And, I hope Trump gets impeached, obviously. But as a lot of people are saying already, everyone from Chris Hedges, if you ever read his stuff, and Truth Dig or whatever, or others, some socialists or influenced by socialists or whatever, obviously the Trump regime is just the tip of the iceberg. Unfortunately, and also the Trump regime is not unheard of, as vile as Trump is. there are historical antecedents, unfortunately. And one of them is the one, this anecdote I keep trying to finish with Nixon. So my friend says, hey, Nixon's a crook. And I'm like, what? And then the Watergate trial opens, and that's on TV every single day. I remember one time I got sick during that. I was out of school for like 2 weeks, literally, because I had this really nice doctor, by the way, who would like, oh, you got a cold, 2 weeks off from school, boom, you know. And my mother would just go along with it. My father would get really angry. But I was like, yeah, I need two weeks off from school. And I got to do a lot of reading. It was beautiful. Actually, it probably saved me as far as like being able to, it's counterintuitive, but the more school I missed, the more reading I got to do. And the more reading I got to do, the more I learned stuff. So when it came to these standardized tests, I did really well on them, relatively speaking. Out of nowhere, there's like, what's this guy doing? You know, I was on the track to, they track people, believe it or not. Yes, of course. In public schools, they sort of track people informally or formally. Back when I was there, it was more formal. And so I was on the, hey, maybe if we're lucky, he'll become an auto mechanic or a carpenter or something. And I sucked at those things. My brothers were great at those things. I sucked at those things. So what am I going to do? This kid that liked to read, you know, it was very unclear to the college guidance counselors where I fit in, you know, especially with a couple siblings that never finished high school. It's like, where are we going to put this kid, you know? And I was in between, you know. It was really weird. I'd have a class that would be like all these kids whose fathers were engineers and stuff, and I'd have a class more along the lines of my people. and it was just strange. And then boom, the stupid, and I'm not defending the standardized tests at all. I'm not defending them. I'm just saying luck of the draw. It's like the lottery for me. So boom, standardized test. And all of a sudden, the guidance counselor is shaking my hand. Hey, he remembers my name. Oh, the principal knows my name. Wow, okay. Hi, principal. Thanks for being nice to me for once, you know, and recognizing who I am and all that. Anyway, that's the anecdote about reading a lot, always plugging reading. Anyway, back to the anecdote, the real anecdote with my friend. He's like, Nixon's a crook. Everything that happened after that showed me Nixon was a crook. That opened up some windows. I don't know what's the right metaphor. Something, the veils fell from my eyes or something, you know, and I started to see more about what the system was about. Now, that's what's not done in a vacuum. I was along with millions of other people starting to see what the system was about. You know, there's this idea that, well, the big demonstrations of the 60s and 70s ended, you know, around the mid-70s, around 74, 75, and when the draft ended. And that's technically true to a certain extent, but it was deeper than that. It was deeper than that. You know, you had, like my brother who was in Vietnam, comes back. He's not rah-rah. He's not Mr. Patriot after that experience at all. Never was after that, actually. You had the big chill set in, so to speak, in the mid to late 70s. That had more to do with the failure of the new left, actually, to create a new political party. Is a big, big reason for that. If you're wondering why radical politics disappeared, it had a lot to do with the draft, but that's not everything. It had a lot to do with the new left not establishing any sort of beachhead politically. They all supported the Democrats. They all thought they were going to reform the Democratic Party. Does that ring a bell now? People that support Sanders and so on? I hope it does. Hope it rings a bell. Because, Sanders is putting forward some great issues and a lot of issues that any socialist would support, any progressive would support. But without getting into the whole history of Sanders, which we've done on the show before, he is firmly embedded with the Democratic Party, despite what you may have thought or read. And he is firmly committed to that project, in his own words, of bringing middle-class people and young people into the Democratic Party. Well, that's a mistake. and there's no there, by the way. You can't actually be a member, in case you're wondering. And you just can be a registered voter, which doesn't mean anything. You can vote for whoever you want within the limited choices they give us. And Sanders, if you want to dig deeper, he does support a lot of policies that support the system. But he does put forward policies that are very... that a lot of corporate bosses do not like, and that's a good thing. Those policies, and sometimes he says this himself, so those policies will never happen without a mass movement. Now, here's the dilemma. Here's the contradiction. The Democratic Party, as defined by its politicians, including Sanders, they do not lead mass movements. They don't do that. They say, no, their priority is get me elected, get others like me elected, and get legislation passed through lobbying and what I will do and what others will do in Congress. And this is not an argument against electoral politics. It's just that's, you know, electoral politics as defined by a corporate political party, boom. That's as far as it's going to go. And even if Sanders sometimes rhetorically says the right thing and says, this is going to take a mass movement, he's not putting his resources, like Our Revolution or whatever, into building a mass movement. He's putting our revolution is going around the country trying to get other, what they consider progressives, elected as Democrats in local office or Congress or whatever. So it's not going to come from there. What could happen if we had a workers' party of some sort, a socialist party, a labor party, whatever, is that what happens in other countries, again, in certain moments of time, not all the time, is that those parties become a focal point and a sort of an umbrella for lots of mass movements, and that mass movements spring out of those parties, out of the unions, with a lot more solid backing than they do in this country usually, that movements can appear and disappear very quickly. Like Occupy had some great aspects to it, but it never had a political party behind it, a left-wing political party, because it doesn't exist in this country. It didn't have the unions behind it. It didn't have things that, you know, you need material force, you need money, you need bodies, you need to, you know, be able to do more than symbolic protest. It's not enough. And I've been on many symbolic protests. And there's time for that, too. You raise consciousness, you use it to organize if you do it right, but there's also limits to it in terms of the threat the system feels, you know. The GM strike that's happening right now, which hopefully we get into, shakes the system more than any number of protests. Now, they're probably going to, wrap this strike up without, it spreading that much. But the fact that it could, and the example that it might set, scares the corporations more than any number of protests that are happening at the same time over issues. And good, you know, it's good that there are protests, but it's a question of how effective can the protests be. And it's true in the labor movement, too. I'm not giving a pass to the labor movement. They can do symbolic picket lines, for example. Picket lines that don't really keep out scabs. Picket lines that don't really disrupt production or disrupt the service or whatever. There's a strike downtown in Boston right now at the Seaport District, the new Seaport District. Of a hotel worker strike in one of those big new hotels down there, and they're doing a little more than symbolic picketing. I'm happy to say, from what I can tell, I haven't got down there yet, but pickets are big. Pickets are going to make people uncomfortable in those, you know, the rich people going to those hotels. It's going to stop a lot of the drivers from going in with supplies and stuff, and that's a good thing, you know. The Stop and Shop strike, which I knew more about than the strike that I just mentioned. And that people in Socialist Alternative were involved in, and others, other union people, you could get trucks to turn around, even non-union, you know, and the Teamsters refused to deliver and stuff like that. It was a strike that became, and it was also got a lot of media attention, and it was one of those interesting strikes where the media starts off anti-union, of course, because that's their default position, that's their go-to position. And as it went on, they were having trouble making the case that this was a bad thing. They'd interview people and say, yes, my shopping has been disrupted. I don't know. But it turns out that fewer and fewer people were saying that kind of thing. They were saying, I support them, you know, it's a good thing, you know. And that's what I felt, you know, that's what was not happening out there. That was happening in the picket lines. That was happening on the streets. There were people. It was like the UPS strike back in 1997, give you another example, 97, 98, something like that. Corporate media starts its usual propaganda against strikers, and I experienced this directly when I was in a union, went on strike, and they inflate the wages. They do an average wage thing, so they'll include the CEO's wage with the worker's wage. The wages are really high, but on average in this place, if you know anything about averages, it's skewed by that high CEO salary, right? And then they'll try to find violence on the picket line, you know, and you know, when I went on strike, one of my coworkers, a woman who was very brave on the picket line, she stood in front of a van of scabs, got her foot run over and broke her foot in many places, broke her bones in her foot in many places. She had to go to the emergency room and all that. And they want to, you know, they're going to talk about violence on the picket line. They're going to turn that against the union somehow instead of someone to say, hey, you don't have to plow your car into people, you know, plow your car to people. You're trying to take away their livelihoods, trying to take away their jobs, you know. So they're looking for, they exaggerate the money, the benefits, the corporate media. They go after, they provoke or report on violence. Media doesn't provoke violence, but I mean, they get people to provoke, the management and the cops sometimes get people to provoke violence on picket lines. Cops provoke violence on picket lines. Number of times I was peacefully walking around a circle and the next minute get shoved so hard my neck whips back from a cop because I stepped over some imaginary line or something. I mean, if I had money for all those times, you know, I'd still be poor, but I still wouldn't have much money, but I'd have more. Anyway, you know, the corporate media does its number. The corporate government does its number, and we don't have an alternative to take advantage of these times when the corporations, the capitalist system is not a monolith, you know, at the top, and when they're fighting each other, this is a time. Boom! There's some space to get in there, and you know, they're divide and conquer from our side for once. You know, we don't have that. Democrats, Pelosi, something like Pelosi, and so on. Not just the corporate Democrats, as they like to say, but all of them, really, they want a certain stability with the system. They know they're not ready for revolution. They're not ready for even, you know, significant. They're just not gonna put in any resources into significant protests. Even, I like how they show up to the strikes in a very symbolic way. You know, and I'm being sarcastic. I don't really like it. I'm so used to the number of picket lines I've been on, and so on. I'm so used to Democrats showing up for the photo, you know, op. I hate it. I just hate it. You know, if they really want to help, and I really don't want a Democratic politician to help, to be really frank with you, or Republican, I don't want that. But say an independent wants to show up, an independent left or independent progressive wants to show up and help a picket line, you got to spend hours on it. You got to really be there. I mean, camp out. I mean, you know, just like, you know, make it your thing for the week at least, you know, if it goes that long. Because, you know, showing up for that photo op is not enough. Now, if you're like a regular person and a worker and you don't have much time and you want to just show up and show your solidarity, walk around the picket line, that's different. That's good. That's very appreciated. But I'm saying someone with resources, right? Someone with real resources. You show up and you share some of those resources, you know? You show up and you get a taste for what this is like. Of course, what you won't have is that deep-set fear in your gut that's always kind of that worrying, nervous fear of, well, what am I going to do if I don't get this job back? And that's what puts a little... little energy into the step, or a little sharpness to the look and talk of someone that's on strike. The GM strikers, all the pictures I'm seeing are, you know, a lot of the pictures I'm seeing are good spirits on the picket line. And I haven't been to any GM pickets. There aren't any around here. But I could tell you that behind every smile, I'll tell you from experience, is a lot of nervousness, obviously, a lot of worry. But on the other hand, it's a time of... A good strike, this is going to sound weird to some people, but a good strike can be a very educational experience, extremely educating. I've seen people learn more in one day on strike than they would learn from talking to, you know, reading or whatever, about what the real class forces are in U.S. society and what the real role of the cops are in U.S. society, ultimately. People learn quick from experience. They really do. People aren't stupid. People are stupid. They're going to vote for Trump. They're going to do this or that. It's not stupid. People can be really ignorant, you know, but people, I see them learn really fast. I've seen people learn really fast. And the people that learn the fastest are not the most educated people, by the way. If you're really... really, really educated under the system, most likely, there are exceptions, but most likely, you're going to be really stuck in that ideological framework, really stuck in it. And, I mean, have more enforcement, reinforcement of that than the average person just soaking up propaganda from the corporate media. So you try to get someone that's, you know, MBA or something, you know, in business. There are exceptions, but you try to get most of them. A fact that will smack down their capitalist ideology right in front of their face will not resonate as great in their consciousness as someone that you know, is not as invested in the system, basically. I mean, same thing for rich people, et cetera. I mean, you know, that might sound like common sense, and it is to a certain extent. It is to a certain extent. And there are, again, there are exceptions. There are people that just like, I can't stand this. I don't believe in this anymore. I'm going to give up the power. I'm going to give up whatever. Now, that doesn't really matter that much as an individual, but it does happen, you know. Anyway, maybe we should talk about the GM strike since I mentioned it, and you want to... what's going on with that? I mean, I'm not here to give you the latest breaking news, but I will say that it looks to me, based on a lot of things I've read and so on, and what a little bit I've heard from people that I've heard from people that are on the picket line. I have to say, I'm talking, you know, second or third hand here, but there is a will to be out there. There is this general knowledge that things are unfair. And I think other strikes paved the way for this, obviously. The West Virginia teacher strike, even the Stop and Shop strike out here in the New England, where there aren't that many GM workers. Well, probably zero in New England. But it's still like the increase in strikes, and statistically speaking, more strikes last year than at any time since 1986. And I forget the percentage, I'm sorry, but we talked about it on another show. This is strikes of 1,000 workers or more. That statistic really jumped up. So around certain places and certain areas, the idea of going on strike is not as terrifying or as strange as it seemed maybe 10 years ago or, maybe even 5 years ago. I remember reading some statistic about strike activity from like around 2012, 2013. It was downright scary. It was so little. It's picked up a lot since then, obviously, because of conditions. Even though you're in a boom, the wages have stagnated. Corporations are still going after benefits and trying to make people work as cheaply as possible. You can see this in non-union, like with the Uber drivers or whatever. You can see it with union concessions made that were completely unnecessary to be made, but they were made. And people are sick of it. And so 59,000 GM workers go out on strike. Not because they all, you know, I mean, so actually they did get to vote on that. So there was some direct democracy there. But there was also just this mood that's out there now that, you know, we can't take this anymore. I mean, there's people working. I've said this before on the show, but I have to stress this. I knew an auto worker in Minneapolis. I was out in Minneapolis doing some political organizing for a socialist candidate named Ginger Jensen for Socialist Alternative that was running for city council. This was before that. I was out in Minneapolis for some other type of organizing, and I spoke to an auto worker who was in Socialist Alternative, and this guy was he was young, very young, he was like, you know, 22 or something, making $11 an hour because of all the concessions that had been made by the union. There's this thing you hear about called a two-tier system in which that just basically means that the unionership accepted the demands of the companies. Or the company, the corporation, to let the older workers, the more experienced workers that have been there a while, get a certain, keep their wage rate, maybe improve it a little bit. But anyone that gets hired, new hired, or any temps they bring in, they've got tons of temps in there now. They are going to get less, and I'm talking a lot less money. I mean, can you imagine working on an assembly line with the value you're adding to these extremely expensive cars that are going to get sold in a big way, and you're adding this indispensable, remember, there's nobody there that's not completely necessary in terms of the function that they do. So you're getting paid $11 an hour for that? Oh, my God. Anyway, and there's other stories like that. Throughout coverage of the strike, which ironically, a lot of the strike coverage, and you should, you know, this is an important point. I learned this point many, many years ago when I first became a socialist. If you want to get some facts you need that you can use, it might take a while to find these facts in where you think you might find them, meaning the mainstream corporate media, New York Times, Boston Globe, whatever your pick your poison. You could look through some of those articles and not find very much useful in terms of understanding the situation from a material standpoint, from a factual standpoint, a scientific, rational standpoint. You might not get much information. Actually, you're going to get propaganda. You're gonna, obviously, corporate propaganda, pro-corporate propaganda. So what I'm going to quote from is, and I'm not just saying the only other place is left-wing progressive stuff. That's true. Union stuff. True. Look for that as an antidote to corporate propaganda. Yes. But also, ironically, the straight-up business press, things like the Wall Street Journal, not the editorial page, things like, I used to say The Economist, but I've been reading The Economist lately, and it's not doing it for me anymore. But what I mean is business journals. There's smaller ones, too, online and still in print, that you can find more information about the economic situation, which is the material basis of what's going on, the reality, the scientific aspect of it in a general sense, than you can in where you expect, to get a quick thing. Like, for example, I was reading some the corporate media in Detroit. I forget what the main paper is there. And reading some of that stuff. And it was completely useless to understanding what was happening. And there's still GM plants around there. So I'm like, gee, they're right at the source, so to speak, and they can't write a story, or they can't broadcast a story that gives you any useful facts to really understand what's going on. They're just there to slam the strikers, and that was the case. Here I'm looking at an Associated Press and article. Not much in here, but I just want to get a few things out. This is from October 2nd. So as of today, the strike is still happening. The press stuff that I've read, the corporate media, but even non-corporate media stuff that I've read lately, here it is October 6th, is that there is negotiations happening, and there's still disagreement on wages and some other important things, but they're getting closer, quote unquote, to an agreement. Now, why is this a step back? Why would this be? What is the strike done? Well, the strike has stopped production in a lot of places, and that's what a strike is supposed to do. They haven't been able to get in enough scabs to keep production going. Therefore, their inventories are being hit. Now, you might have heard of just-in-time inventory and all these other things that parts suppliers that GM controls or uses that or both that are their inventory is running out. But inventory on finished product as well, stuff that they want to shove into the car lots at the auto lots, the car. What am I doing? I can't remember the name for the place that you go to buy a car at, the car sales places, auto dealerships. I guess that's the one phrase. They are going to run out of product real soon, and that is worrying, of course, to the corporate rulers, not just GM, but others that depend. There's a lot of stuff that depends on the auto industry, not just the parts suppliers, but there's a whole, higher end to the industry that isn't really creating much value, but is part of the selling of the vehicle or the PR, public relations, propaganda, advertising, commercial advertising about the vehicle and so on. And there's other jobs related to that. But getting back to the basic jobs that create the value, the manufacturing jobs and so on, partially probably because there is a kind of a boom in the economy in the sense of low unemployment, relatively low unemployment. There's more than they say, of course, but relatively low. That might be part of the problem in getting the scabs they want to go in and try to work. It's not working for them, which is good. When I went on strike years ago, then they were bringing in scabs. They paid them three times what we were earning. But problem was, as low skilled as they say, like factory work and other type of work is, there's still a lot of skill involved, actually. And so it takes a long time to get scab workers, unless they've already worked in the industry, to up to speed. We stopped as many as we could. We did things to the product in the stores that I won't name. We did, a lot of protesting. We did a lot of stuff. And they just weren't able to get any product out that was any good. And this was a big General Foods bakery. They weren't able to get out stuff that people could stand to eat. And they On top of that, they had a lot of just a horrible publicity because, you know, a lot of workers were involved, and they would go out and tell the stories of what the reality was. And as the strike went on, word sort of gets out a little bit, especially in smaller cities or towns where there are strikes. And the Teamsters, this is really key, were convinced to stop delivering, as union sisters and brothers, to stop delivering stuff, and the train workers as well, unionized train workers. So all of a sudden, these big, giant food manufacturing, or in this case, rolls, bread, pies, English muffins, you name it, all that kind of stuff, they're not getting things like flour. Gee, kind of need that. No flour coming in. Other additives they add, not coming in. Plastic bags to shove it into. Yeah, that's not coming in either. And so they just all of a sudden, what was a trickle of product came down to very little, and because of the strike. And that puts you in a position to win. And we won our strike, actually. I think I don't want to predict because I don't know as much detail as we should know about this. But it looks like they're headed for a victory. The auto workers here. The leadership, though, is very, very weak. It's of the UAW been giving concessions since many decades now, and they also are some of the top leaders of the UAW is under investigation for taking union funds and splurging and luxuries and so on, and people are taught to believe in this country that that kind of corruption among unions is there a lot, but it's actually not. That happens a lot, actually doesn't happen a lot, although union leadership salaries are too high. They should be making the same amount of money that the workers make, but they usually make a lot more, unfortunately. There's some exceptions, like the union that I used to be in, the United Electrical Workers, they had a rule in the union that the president would only make the top wage, his top wage could only be the average wage of the highest paid workers in the union. So it couldn't go above, and in fact, was, I think, was a little bit below the highest paid workers in the union in whatever plant that might be, whatever place that might be. I think it was General Electric at the time. Anyway, back to the strike still happening as of a couple hours ago. The union is threatening to do a thing I find very interesting. It should be like common sense. If they reach a settlement in the strike, the union is still going to stay on strike while the workers look at the agreement and decide whether to vote yes or no. Usually, unfortunately, in recent times, the unions tell the workers to go. The union leadership will say, "We got to go back to work," before the workers have studied the contract and figured out whether to vote yes or no. So once you're back in the plant and you get all the pressure from the unionship to vote yes, it's usually what they want. Now, that doesn't always work. And that's a good thing, especially if it goes beyond one factory. Like the Teamsters recently had a contract that covered many, many workplaces in different parts of the country. And so they had to do a mail-in ballot, and they had to, the workers weren't, most of them weren't on strike. Vast majority weren't on strike. But the point is that they had to come in. It's a slightly different situation because of that, but they had to come in. The pressure from the union leadership usually works. Didn't work in this case. And they voted, a majority voted no, and then the president of the Teamsters found some constitutional clause to overcome that, which was unfair and wrong, and he's on his way out, basically. That's another story. Back to the GM strike. So this is a few days old, this information. It's basically like... quote, Associated Press here, General Motors offered striking union members wage increases or lump sum payments in all 4 years of proposed contract as the walkout was in its third week. Says, quote, but union bargainers rejected the offer because it took money from other places to fund profit sharing, and it didn't give temporary workers a clear path to a full-time job, according to a person briefed on the negotiations. Now, you're already getting, if you're listening to this, an idea that there's many different issues involved in the strike, and there are. There's basic pay. There's basic benefits like time off. they have a thing called profit sharing, which isn't exactly what it sounds like, but it's very skewed, obviously, against the workers, but they get a little bit, they get bonuses, like, there's this thing, unfortunately, of taking lump sum payments in addition to percentage raises. But there's also temps. There's this, like I said earlier in the show, there's increased use of temps, temporary workers, who are kept at a lower wage. There's the two-tier wage system. I don't predict that the strike will end the two-tier wage system, but it'll hopefully make inroads against it. They quote 49,000 workers here. I thought it was 59,000. Anyway, it's affecting work in other places, Mexico, Canada, and so on. Basically it's just talking about, this is from Market Watch, by the way. This is who published this AP story. That's what I was kind of, part of what I meant about the sources of, sometimes you get better facts from the business publications. If you're just looking for basic facts, not their editorialization. Quote, among the union's big problems with the Monday offer is a provision requiring temporary workers to be employed for three uninterrupted years before they automatically become full-time. So you take in temps, and there's supposed to be a path to full employment, and that path becomes longer and longer. Each contract negotiation, they're trying to reverse that. Full-time workers on the picket line say they want to see temporary workers get permanent jobs, of course. A lot of the UAW workers, whatever their political consciousness, at least they have basic lessons, and this strike will reinforce that, about solidarity and be able to care for another worker and say, well, if that worker is doing well, I'm going to do well, not just trying to get their own deal. Because if you try to get your own deal, it's going to fall apart at some point, whether it's in a union environment or non-union environment. For workers who were hired before 2007, the Monday night offer includes 2% raises in 2020 and 2022, as well as 2% lump sum payment in 2019 and 3% in 2021. Workers would also get an $8,000 ratification bonus to try to kind of bribe them to vote for the contract, as whatever, however the offer turns out. And a cap would be lifted on profit sharing. We would. I don't quite believe that last one. A cap would be lifted, but they're going to find ways to calculate that differently, I would bet anything. But anyways, so that's a bunch of numbers I just threw out, all kind of low, all very low, actually. Now, especially if you're in that those categories of temp worker or two-tier worker that has been struggling under a lower wage. See, once you start at a lower wage, if raises are based on your percentage pay, then that lower wage has hurt you indefinitely, you know? Unless you get a huge jump. And even then, it would hurt you compared to other workers that were started at a higher wage. They say that about workers that start working in recessions in general in the economy. If you start work in a recessionary year, most likely you're never going to catch up to people that started work in a non-recessionary year. That's, you know, all things considered, that's, you're not laid off, et cetera, all sorts of qualifiers there. But basically, they've studied this. Some economists have studied this and found that even in a non-union workplace, or especially a non-union workplace, actually, raises based, if they exist at all, on your percentage salary, a percentage based on your salary, and your salary starts low and stays low comparatively because each increase is still lower because of that. Once you, not percentage-wise, but in terms of what you actually get, the aggregate amount, then that's, you never catch up, basically. Full-time workers hired after 2007 who are now paid less than older workers would get the same profit sharing and ratification bonuses, but they would not get pay raises other than the steps on the pay scale negotiated in the last contract. So that's a horrible, horrible thing. That's the two-tier system. So it goes into more details like that. I'd urge you to read on your own more about this, where you can find information online or wherever. The union that wants new hires to eventually make as much as older production workers who are paid $30 per hour. Again, that's probably an average or a cap. I don't think most workers get that. I hope they do. But with the two-tier system and the concessions made over the years, unnecessarily in recent years, over 15, 20 years, you have to suspect any kind of wage top wage figures that are given in a strike situation. By the way, these ratification bonuses and lump sum payments I mentioned earlier, these are taxed